Hi there, it's Ryland Walker Knight. We're back a day later on Vinylist Podcast. Once again, Mark couldn't make it. I know you guys were waiting to hear him, but it's okay. I'm with Brian Darr, and here's Brian for a second to say hi. Yep, there he is. We just watched some avant-garde films at the PFA Library, the Pacific Film Archive Library, which is tied to UC Berkeley. And if you're a member, you can go and reserve the room for a price.
I think you can do it even if you're not a member, but it's a cheaper price if you are a member.
I didn't do that enough or ever when I was a student this past 2 years. I should have, because this was phenomenal. I also am not that versed in the avant-garde, but it really intrigues me. As my interests in the cinema develop and have developed, really just an interest in images more than anything. And Brian has been at this a little bit longer than me, this cinephile thing, and he thought of this idea as a way to inaugurate a certain interest, and it worked because we saw some really beautiful things. I saw my first brackage on 16mm. First brackage period, really. I mean, I think I'd seen a clip from Dog Star Man on the internet somewhere, but that doesn't count. I don't think. So which one did we see first? We saw the short one first, right? We saw
Anticipation of the Night, and then we saw Mothlight.
Right. Anticipation of the Night isn't on the Criterion DVD, and so that was a real treat. I think it's 40 minutes long. And we'll try to get to that. That thing is immense. There's a lot happening there, I think. And I don't really have the vocabulary yet, I don't think. But I think we might be able to say some other things. But we also, that wasn't the only thing we saw. We started with, what did we start with?
Kenneth Anger, I can't really pronounce French words very well, but his 1953 film beginning with an E.
D'Artifice. Do you want to just go through the list of what we watched?
Okay, we started with that, then we went to the brackage, and then after that we watched a couple films from Bruce Bailey, the San Francisco, I guess he's in Seattle now, but he founded Canyon Cinema. Back in 1961 or something like that, and we watched All My Life, and we watched Mass for the Dakota Sioux. And then we saw two films from James Benning and Betty Gordon, or I don't know if it's Bette Gordon, I'm not sure.
My grandma is Betty.
Okay, maybe Betty Gordon. And those two films were called Michigan Avenue and... I-94, I think, is the other one.
Yeah.
And then we finished off with two that they showed on DVD, which were Bruce Conner's Report and Take the 510 to Dreamland.
Right. Yeah, and here's an admission. I have had a long day, and I took a little nap through the Benning, which is really a bummer because I... I guess it started in the Bailey.
Oh, and the Benning too?
Yeah, I think, yeah. I, yeah. I think so. and I was really bummed because I saw RR a couple weeks ago or a month ago or something, and that was really phenomenal. Like, that's probably a perfect movie. It's a little, you know, we could talk about that some. Did you see that ever?
No, I missed RR. It was on a Tuesday night, which is shamefully like the one night I can't get out to the PFA ever.
Right.
And it's really sad because it's also the night that they're most consistently do avant-garde programs.
Right.
But yeah, so I've missed RR. But I have seen a few other Benning films in
right.
the recent year.
You've written about The Lakes and The Skies, right?
Yeah, 13 Lakes and 10 Skies. And I also saw Casting a Glance at Sundance last year, which was really one thing that was interesting about Michigan Avenue is I'm pretty sure that some of the same soundtrack from Michigan Avenue is something that I heard in either 10 Skies or Casting a Glance, because it's just so familiar sounding, this particular kind of gurgling water sound. And I don't know what the deal was exactly, but I do know that I've read somewhere that he reuses his soundtracks, especially in his more recent work. He's been reusing soundtracks from his older films a lot. I don't know exactly why, but it was really interesting to have this familiar gurgling sound accompanying these images, which were, so you didn't see this at all because you were asleep?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I wish I had coffee instead of tea before we went in there, but that's that, you know, someday. I think, you know, now the internet knows that I'm moving to New York, so I can probably wrangle a screening somewhere of some of these things again. And I'm really looking forward to that possibility. There's a lot of you cool people out there in the blogosphere that I know like a lot of these cool things, and I can pick your brain as well once I'm in New York. But yeah, then we ended with the Bruce Conner, which was phenomenal, even on DVD. Like, we were both kind of apprehensive that they weren't actually going to be on 16mm. I thought we were seeing a complete 16mm program, but... And in Report, there's this long sequence of just flicker, and it somehow took on a really cool effect, even digitally. I guess it must be a different affect, a different effect on 16. But I was really moved by that piece of art. That was like, because it's hilarious as well as just like scary.
Yeah, I always forget how hilarious it is. I mean, because it is really scary and dark and like mournful.
Maybe we should say what it's about.
Well, yeah, obviously. Report is all of the soundtrack footage, and more than half of the images are from the assassination of President Kennedy. So,
yeah.
Like the radio news reports, radio reports of that's what makes up the soundtrack. And then images. I'm not sure if that's the Zapruder footage. Or,
no,
I don't think so. No.
It's just newsreel.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Other stuff.
Yeah. I haven't watched the Zapruder more than once. It was like.
Yeah, I've seen JFK, and that's about as often as I need to see that footage. But then the second half, I guess there's more other stuff outside of Dallas. And he's building an argument of like juxtapositions, and but it's still really, really like, ouch. He takes the news footage of Lee Harvey Oswald getting shot, and he stops it on the shooting and the face there, and even though that guy might have been a patsy, or he might have actually done it. Like, he's a villain, you know, like that. You still don't want to see that. It's such a terrifying confrontation in a way. And then we saw 5:10 to Dreamland after that, which is just like delicious. Just like I could live in that little moment a lot. It's only 7 minutes long, and it's sort of sepia. There's this beautiful moment where this. You were saying that it's all found footage.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that 5:10 to Dreamland is one of his all found footage films. I mean, his first film, a movie, was all found footage. And a lot of his other films, Mongoloid is another all found footage, or Permian Strata, Report is all found footage. Yeah. But he's also made films like The White Rose, like Looking for Mushrooms, where he actually is using the camera himself as well, to taking footage. But I think that by 1976, at that moment, he was kind of doing just the found footage stuff, at least for a little while longer. And the thing about take the 5:10 to Dreamland is, I mean, just the images are just amazing.
Yeah.
Like, by that point, he had such a reputation of being the found footage guy that he had all sorts of stuff sent to him from friends. You know, if they encountered some educational film or weird newsreel, they would, like, send it to him, and he just was able to really amass an incredible collection of stuff to work with, a palette, shall I say.
My favorite moment, I mean, actually, I like every image in that film, but the most hilarious and ridiculous moment to me is the girl with the basketball. For the people who have seen 5:10 to Dreamland, you'll know what I mean right there, but for those who haven't, I don't know, it's maybe like 12 images, and they're separate, I don't know, maybe 15. I wasn't taking notes. I don't ever really take notes during films. I don't know. Unless it's like the fifth time and I really want to like start working on something. Anyways, there's only about like 12 or 15 images, and they're all separated by a fade into black and fade up. And the one that just made me kind of like laugh a bit was this girl getting ready to play basketball. she's like fixing her hair in the mirror for a minute, and then she turns around, and then there's this weird cut to the mirror itself, and just the number on the back of her, on her back, on her jersey, which is like, you know, it's got a collar, and that's funny too, because, you know, anachronisms. And it holds on her back, and she doesn't move for a long time before it pulls back to another long shot of her walking away from the mirror and then off camera again. And it seemed like so like precise that I was like, he didn't film that. And also, like, the number 12 in the mirror looks like C to me, like, just yes. And I don't know, that really made me laugh.
I'm positive that he didn't film everything, but there's definitely a lot of compiled footage. The animation of the candle is definitely from some industrial somewhere. And, of course, the famous shot of the droplet in slow motion. That's been done to death, I guess, but he does it so much more beautifully than you've ever seen it with that soundtrack. It's one of my favorite of his soundtracks. Often he has a found footage found soundtrack as well, but this one is one that was composed specifically for the film, and I'm feeling dumb right now because I can't remember who.
Yeah, I didn't write his name down. Haha, but yeah, that it's his music by somebody, and then the end, and it's just a really gentle movie, even though like there's like the bullet, and I think it does start with like that milk droplet, and like just you feel like creation. it's just everything feels tactile because of that, and then of course that beautiful final image of the rain before the final fade is just like it's been really cold in the Bay Area too, so that there's a little resonance there for me. I'm feeling dumb too, because I don't really normally encounter these kinds of films, but I think more people should, of course. I think anybody who encounters one of these beautiful things wants more people to encounter them, because the possibilities are, what cliche can I say? And that's one thing that I always am curious to know from cinephiles is, not only like what movies do you like and like that, but like where did it start? And so, but when we were eating after this little program, I asked Brian what text it was that really sparked an interest in the avant-garde for him. And he was generous to offer an answer that he was generous enough to repeat here. So I'm going to turn it over again.
Okay, well, I guess it's we've been on Bruce Conner. I mean, it was Bruce Conner, so that's kind of a good segue. definitely the first time I was just absolutely wowed by avant-garde film was The White Rose by Bruce Conner from 1967, I believe. It was showing at the old De Young Museum in San Francisco when they had a exhibition on the art of the beats. And one of the beats, I probably will butcher this pronunciation, Defeo. Defeo. Yeah. She painted something called The Rose, which was like this incredible painting that she took over a decade, I think, to basically build up. And she just kept adding and adding and adding, adding oil paint on layer after layer over the years until, you know, the final product, I guess it was a final product. I don't know if she ever considered it finished, but the paint itself weighed an incredible amount, and it was thicker than the frame. And so this film was made of her trying to move that painting out of her apartment, which was an incredibly difficult task. And
How big is the painting, like, dimension-wise?
It's very large. Like, big enough that they had to cut like, the wall out and put it out over the fire escape and then take a crane from there to move it out of her, like, Pacific Heights apartment at the time. And so Conner was filming that, and he's got sketches of Spain from Miles Davis on the soundtrack, and I was just like, I want to watch this again. So luckily they had it on repeat, so I watched it a bunch of times and saw the painting for myself. And then a few years later, just hearing about a Bruce Conner screening, I remembered that name for some reason, or maybe I'd researched it. I can't remember. And, you know, they showed... This was at the SF Cinematheque when they were doing screenings at the Art Institute, San Francisco Art Institute. And they showed Report, they showed a movie, they showed Cosmic Ray, they showed The White Rose again, and they showed Breakaway. That's like, that's enough. You're hooked.
Yeah, I can imagine.
It's just been such a, you know, I don't know, this year with him passing away back in, I guess it was July. It was right around 4th of July. And just now it's very hard to see his films for some many reasons, I guess. Like he actually just discontinued his association with Canyon Cinema, which had been his distributor. So you can't rent his films from Canyon. And
and that DVD we watched is pretty rare, right?
Yeah, the DVD was put out by some art gallery in LA. It's called Bruce Conner 2000 BC.
Right.
It was part of it was put out as part of this exhibition, and a book was published. But I think that the DVD was like very limited edition, and maybe even recalled like immediately after it was put out for various reasons. And so it's the first time I'd ever seen anyone with a copy of that DVD. I was kind of hoping for 60mm prints, but I think it ended up working out pretty good.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, Easter Morning, his last film. If anyone is still looking for great films from 2008 to program, short films, you know, hopefully they'll look at Easter Morning because that's making the rounds. And hopefully lots of people will be able to see that. And then Luke from a few years ago just seems like a particularly apt tribute to him right now.
Right.
Because it was filmed on the set of Making Cool Hand Luke. Bruce Conner was for some reason there, and he was able to film like all these shots of Paul Newman in the distance and stuff like that. So with Paul Newman and Bruce Conner, the double whammy of 2008, it would be like, you know, somebody should program that. It's that. But, you know, I don't know. I haven't.
Technology's where you're at. Yes, I agree. I look forward to seeing that someday in my life in the near future. And other things. I realized after we got out that I saw a cosmic ray on the internet, I don't know, like a month ago or something. David Phelps posted a link to it, I think from his blog, Video Arcadia. And that was awesome, even though it was, you know, digitally corrupted and stupidly small and, you know, not loud enough even on my headphones. The thing I like about him, even in that terrifying report, is a sense of fun. Like, there's definite enjoyment of whatever you're seeing. The gaze is just joyful and loving. It's generosity, and that's really awesome. Which is different. I mean, the brackage, we can segue into that, because I think there is a lot of love in that film we saw.
Anticipation of the Night.
Yeah, Anticipation of the Night. I was like, Instigation? Jesus Christ, I'm dumb. Yeah, Anticipation of the Night. His baby is in it, and the camera's just like hanging out in the grass with this baby. And it looks like the most beautiful little thing in the world, having a fun time. But and then when he finally turns night, he's at a fairground, and there's a Ferris wheel in the background. All these kids are spinning in cups, and he frames it so perfectly, so you don't even see the cups, and it just looks like these little alien bodies just flying through space, and it's all red and
very fast.
Yeah, everything is really fast, and it's there's not much pause. The most pause you get is like towards the end when he's driving through trees. And yeah, it just seems, I don't know.
And suddenly there's a polar bear.
Yeah.
No, I love the thing. One of the things I love about Brackage, having seen a few of his films over the years, is like he really is documenting his life. You know, he's working with the world that he's in and, you know, having his own child in the film, it feels like it connects everything. I don't know. There are other films he's made where his child was being born, and he's had films with where his children are older, or like Dog Star Man itself is like basically the epic of his own, like moving to Colorado and building out this life for himself there. And there's just something really. It feels dismissive to say this, but it's like the most incredibly artful home movie you could ever imagine.
Right.
I don't want to be dismissive to say that, but that in a way that there's that aspect to Brackage.
Right, yeah. I mean, definitely. And that's the thing I'm kind of doing with my stupid little things that I've put on YouTube and iMeme. And that somebody told me I should put on Vimeo because that like looks better, but I kind of like how degraded YouTube it can be, kind of. I don't know. I like that, because what I'm not using 16 millimeter or even 8 millimeter. I'm using a little Canon point and shoot that has a video capability, as the technology is amazing right now, and it just really tickles me that I can just whip this out, that I can just pull this. I can take my camera anywhere and. My face did a lot of things right there, and I can just capture something, and then I can have something of my friend, throwing a rock, you know, and then I can stitch it together. I have like all these ideas about duration and stuff, so my things are a lot slower, and maybe kind of boring, but I don't know.
That makes me think of All My Life, and you're talking about slower duration. What did you think of that? Because you, I don't know.
I was awake for that one, and that was lovely. It was, I mean, the print is just beautiful. Do you want to?
Okay. Well, yeah, basically it's this this one-shot movie, 3 minutes long, Bruce Bailey film that basically tracks this fence with a flowing grass in front and growing roses on top, and then the beautiful blue sky above. And I don't know. Can you elaborate?
Yeah, the camera's moving to the left. Yeah, and it's a meeting. It's a meeting of, I don't know, matter. That's what I saw. It's just all these different forms of the earth meeting and coalescing, and then the camera is just panning along them to the left, and like it's sort of like a lattice with the fence and the roses and the green, and then slowly you start to notice the camera is tilting up a bit, and then so the blue starts to take over the frame, and the world sort of the meeting of the matter and the matter sort of recede a bit down in the frame, but then the sky takes on a whole nother level of like worldness. World is such a big word. Until it's all blue, and then the title of the Ella Fitzgerald song and the credit of that comes on, and
we've been listening to that song for the whole shot.
Right.
So
it's lovely.
Guess what filmmaker pointed me to that as an influence? Apichatpong Weerasethakul.
Oh, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah, apparently he was a huge, huge Bailey fan. I think he was probably exposed to the stuff when he was studying in Chicago.
Right.
And once I started reading about that in interviews, I was like, I need to track down this Bruce Bailey cat. And that was the film that just blew me away the most.
Yeah, and their print is just beautiful. Like, pay the $15, people, and go look at it. Like, you can just program that, probably, and the brackage, and you'll have a party. I mean, wow.
Of course, it's all supposed to be for research purposes. I don't really know.
It's not like I'm making any money on this goofy podcast. I said on the one yesterday, like, I think I am just going to post this tonight, even though it might glut my little corner of the internet that, you know, like, I don't know how many people, like 5 look at it. I think maybe we have 15 readers at Vinyl is Heavy. That's good enough for me. Anyways, as I said last time, what was I talking about? I just tried to make jokes and I forgot everything.
I haven't listened to it yet.
Yeah. No, I wrote something on the post of it about it that I wanted to reference. Doesn't matter, clearly. Like, I'm just...
Okay, how about Kenneth Anger? What did you think?
Oh, yeah, Kenneth Anger. Jesus Christ, that was awesome. That was my first encounter with him. That was the first thing we started with. And O Doughty Feast, you know, Water of Artifice. It's really Baroque. It's... a lot of water, so of course I like that. I like water a lot, and it's like bedraggled beyond belief.
Sure that this has been mentioned before, but it's the first time that it occurred to me. This is my second time seeing the film. That, you know, for a guy who made fireworks for his first film, I mean, he turned that water into looking like the most sparkly, like celebratory thing you can imagine.
It just looks like light. It doesn't look like water in the close-ups, because there's these close-ups against a black background that it just looks like light erupting, and it's so beautiful. I was trying to develop an argument about it in terms of how it's like gonna organize the space this lady is traversing. Basically, it's a lot of fountains around this. I guess that's around L.A. somewhere, maybe.
I'm not sure where it was shot.
Yeah. Well, you said he's from L.A., so that was what I was thinking. But there's a lot of fountains going on. Then I guess he probably turned hoses on, too, to get these stairs wet at certain points. But there's a lady just walking around this park. She's all maquillaged up in, like, 18th century garb. And she's got a big haired thing. It's all very, I don't know, pretty. And
was it Vivaldi on the soundtrack? Maybe Bach. Sorry.
I wish I knew classical music better. I've been saying that a lot recently. But yeah, beautiful music. All and then this weird space, and a lot of it is just her going down these stairs through, past a lot of fountains, and then but then sometimes she wanders through like a few sprays, and looks still looks perfect. And there's also these kind of scary close-ups of these fountain heads that are spewing water, but he shoots it at the, from the beginning. The first time you see him, they don't really look like they're spewing. It looks like they could be getting water pouring into their mouths. The angle is weird enough, and I guess maybe the print was old enough or something that I was a little bit confused. Also, like at one point, a drop of water like flies up into the eye of one of them, and it looks like a reverse tear, and it's just kind of beautiful. And I gasped a little bit. But yeah, that's my problem, I guess, with a lot. My problem with not having the vocabulary is like I don't know how to resolve all my redescriptions of it. I don't know where I'm going with it. You know, a lot of it is just about the feeling I'm feeling while I'm watching it.
I think that I don't know, that's one of the things that I really believe about an avant-garde film, is that, like, it kind of scares people away, the whole idea of, you know, having to be really serious about it or write about it in a particularly particular tone. But I'm certainly no expert, and I just dive in. That's what I try to do, you know, just like, okay, I use the vocabulary I have. I'm not a genius. I'm not going to, like, you know, be the second coming of, you know, some, I don't know, Manny Farber or even Scott, you know, Scott McDonald or somebody who else who really knows how to talk about this stuff.
Yeah.
But I just talk about it in the way I know how, you know, I can do it.
Yeah. And to some degree. Anyway.
And if you have fun doing that, yeah, I mean, yeah, I like, I've liked everything you've written on your blog about all the stuff. It's made me want to do this. It made me, like, all your stuff about Bruce Conner when he passed away. It was like, I feel like I'm missing something, and I was, clearly. And, yeah, I really appreciate that. Yeah, you really should just dive in. I think that's something that we wanted to get at in our very first podcast, talking about melodrama, and it's a similar thing in general. I think it's the defense mechanism to keep things at bay is, you know, obvious around town, you know, like I think things, it's sort of like when things get bad in the world, people look for answers or they can either just go with it. And it's really rare that people just want to go with it. That's the thing. They want answers. I mean, I do. Like, I want to know how to resolve this feeling besides just like kind of like a giddiness. As much as I like love that I feel like a billion times better than I did at 10 a.m., you know, like the project of understanding is such a compulsion. I don't know if it's really healthy sometimes, you know, but I don't know. So thank you is a lot of what I'm saying.
Well, thank you, because I probably wouldn't have gotten to see like the betting films. I wouldn't have gone out of the way to do it.
Do you want to talk about that a bit, since I don't have anything to say about it?
Well, I guess I should just describe them a little bit. Michigan Avenue is, I mean, of the five filmmakers, I would say, like, these films were the trickiest.
Okay.
Like, and I would say Anger's films were maybe the least tricky, or maybe well, All My Life isn't very tricky either. But, you know, but I would say that the Benning films were, they just astonished me what was going on, what he was doing in the early 70s here. Michigan Avenue is a very, very slowed down imagery. It like lurches forward, like frame by frame. It's like slow motion of a kind you've never really seen before. And like different objects in the frame are moving at different speeds. So at first you think that like part of the image is still and the other image, part of the image is moving.
Wow.
It's really an interesting effect. And like the first shot is just of people walking down Michigan Avenue, I think Chicago. And he just holds on that for like a minute or maybe something like that, 2 minutes, like these people walking down the street, but they don't even probably get a full step in. Maybe if they do get a step, and then this car is going around the corner and you can see the car, but then you can only barely perceive that the people are moving too. And then he's got these nudes, these nude women, and you know, they're just lying in bed and they're doing the same thing basically. One of them is rolling off the bed, the other one is just sitting there. And she looks like it's like still life plus very slow movement. I don't know. It was just beautiful and amazing, and I don't have the foggiest idea how he was doing that, you know, creating these little lurches. I don't know if he was like reproducing the print, you know, each frame. Or, I don't know what he was doing. That's one thing that's cool about it. And then the other film, I-94, he's like alternating these two images. Again, a nude, a female nude walking away from you and a male nude walking towards you, but you're seeing them at the same time. It's all about the persistence of vision, and there's like a giant freeway overpass and above them, and there's a semi-truck that rolls over them, and he's doing the same thing with the soundtrack, because the soundtrack, you're hearing both the man and the woman speak at the same time, but like at first when the woman is near you, you hear her voice and you can just barely hear the man's, and then when they're in the middle of the film, you're hearing them both about the same volume, and then when the woman's far away and the man's close, you can hear his, and she's indistinct. So he's doing the same. It's very symmetrical and like precise.
That makes sense. From what little I know of him, that I could see that would be something he's exploring back then too.
I shouldn't say he, because you know he's doing it with Betty Gordon too, and yeah, I don't know enough about that that relationship. Let's be honest, we picked the film because we were like Benning was a big name, and we're like, let's see some early Benning films that neither of us have seen before. But you know, I want to look into this Betty Gordon person too.
Sure.
And I do feel a little bit sad that like the only female filmmakers on this program, the only female filmmaker on this program was like inadvertent. I definitely was looking for stuff in the PFA collection by women filmmakers, but they didn't have anything that was showable from the ones that I was looking for. So.
Yeah, that's too bad. I mean, that's always a lack. like I didn't get to see Wendy and Lucy this year, but I would really like to soon.
You'll see it next year. You'll see it in New York.
Yeah, I hope. Yeah, that'd be cool. I mean, I didn't see the Breya either. I don't know. Anyways, I didn't see the new Denis that was at Toronto. That's probably my biggest But you know, I just didn't go. So whatever. It'll get released. She's a big enough name. It just sounds like everything I like, you know, trains and family, and movies and Gregoire Collin, but that's another conversation. I think this is long enough. I think we had a good talk.
Thank you. I enjoyed it too.
So, you know, go watch, if you live in Berkeley or Oakland or even San Francisco or Richmond or Marin County and you have the compulsion, go look at the PFA website. I'll put a link up, and I don't know, have some fun.
Thank you.